Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by the boss, John Roerink, our special guest this week, Dennis Muchmore. Thanks for coming on up to MERS World Headquarters. Good to see you.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's almost like the Arctic up here. We're having an Arctic blast next week, and you guys are conserving. Yeah, it must be part of the Green New Deal.
We're preparing you for the future. Winter is coming.
The Green New Deal, I figure. Is what?
And I hear, I thought, John, you were storing some of your fish up here or something. Some of your frozen fish. You'd run out of room in your fridge over at home, and you're putting it up here. No, this weather, I think, it's taken us off guard a little bit. Going from the 50s to the 30s is a...
And we're supposed to set records next week. Right, 170 records cross country are supposed to fall as an Arctic blast comes through.
Ooh. All right, bring the winter coat out. Representative Joe Tate from Detroit will be joining us in a little bit. But first, Dennis, appreciate you coming down here. Tell our listeners what you've been doing since you left Governor Snyder's office as his chief of staff.
Well, I went to work for Honigman, Miller, Schwartz, and Cohn at the time, and now it's called Honigman LLC or LLP, and. I've enjoyed it. It's a co-practice leader with Peter Riddell in the government relations and the regulatory practice. And there's 23 or 25 people, depending on what day of the week it is and whether I've said something outrageous inside the firm.
How's it like working with Peter Riddell? Does he wear a bow tie every day or just every other day?
He wears a bow tie every day, and it's really obnoxious. He's softening up a little bit because he's going to be a horse owner pretty soon because what? His wife and two daughters are working him into owning horses. So he's going to be a gentleman farmer here pretty quick.
He doesn't have any space at his East Lansing home for that, does he?
No, he'll actually have to rent space, put the horse in, pay for the vet bills and all the stuff. And I'm sure he'll be looking for a raise from the bosses next month.
That's an expensive hobby.
That is a very expensive hobby. I've had them, lots of them. So, horses are good for two things, and I don't want to get into it because it goes against my Humane Society support. But, Peter's going to find out what it's like.
Yeah, well, I'm sure. Well, that's very exciting. So you've still had a front row seat then to watch what's been going around the Capitol. Give us your assessment of how Governor Whitmer has done and Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky and the Speaker Lee Chatfield.
As a group or individually?
Let's start individually with the governor.
Well, we can start individually, I guess. She's got a lot of experience. She's been around town all of her life. Her father was... a significant player in Michigan politics for a long time. And she was the minority Senate leader. So she's got a lot of experience, a lot of background. I don't really think she's awed by the job, but I think she likes a little more than she thought she was going to. But I don't really have any reason for saying that, except just seems like it to me. Mike Shirky, one of the smartest guys I've been around my political career. I think he's really a bright guy, very talented, very smart guy, a little stubborn. Occasionally he'll get a little backed up, but he really has an agile mind and knows what he's doing. The Speaker of the House, Lee Chatfield, exceptionally bright guy, somewhat of a surprise to me. When he took the spot, I thought, who's this young guy taking this spot, and what in the world are they thinking? And I've discovered that not only does he know what he's doing and have a pretty good head on his shoulders, but he can count, and that's the only thing you really need to be able to do when you're the Speaker of the House. If you can count, you can control, and he's a pretty good Speaker of the House. I'd say one of the best in the last 20 years, 25 years.
I've been really surprised by how politically crafty he is. He really is playing the game.
He is, and I'm impressed by him. He asks people, even people he doesn't agree with, what they would do differently or how they would approach something.
And he genuinely
catalogs it. Yeah, there's no question about it. He's one of those kind of people. He's a sponge. He likes to absorb what other people do and think. And I asked him one time about who he's talking to, and he told me that he was um, he spent a lot of time looking at what Mike Madigan, the Speaker of the House in Illinois, does, which kind of floored me because Mike Madigan's politics and personality are a long way away from what I perceive Lee Chatfield's are. But he said to me something that convinced me that he knew what he was doing. And he said, well, he's been Speaker of the House for 37 years, so he must know what he's doing. And I thought to myself, now that is a sign of somebody who's, you know, who's open to ideas and is going to use what works. And then he told me lots of times he talks to Gary Owen about what goes on.
Oh, that's cool.
I think I think that has a lot to do with it. You know, he's always looking for advice. And
so why are we spinning our tires right now on the 2020 budget?
Well, I think it's simply because you've got a couple of legislative leaders that, you know what they're doing. And typically, a governor has all the power and sets the agendas and sets the appropriations lines and what's going to happen. And I think in lots of these cases that the two legislative leaders have discovered that that appropriations is the key to everything themselves. Now, that's not always the case with, for instance, Speaker of the House. Lots of Speaker of the House don't know anything about appropriations. Mm-hmm. But Chatfield does, and he's learned how it works. And if you know something about appropriations, you can control the territory of what goes on the floor, what's possible to do, what's passable. And I think he's using that knowledge. You know, part of the problem with the governor is that, frankly, for a long time, she's been in the minority as a legislator. And you know, you kind of get in a minority headset for a while. You know, you begin to look at things like other people are stopping you from doing something. And I don't really think that's the case. When you're the governor, nobody stops you from doing what you want. You only stop yourself. And so I think, as time goes on, she get more comfortable with it. And 9 months isn't very long in a governor's term.
Is it fair to say she was outfoxed on this one?
No, I don't. You know, I don't know. Think that's probably the right phrase. I just think that when you get people who are dealing on the same level of knowledge about how to, you know, to deal with these kinds of major issues, like people always criticize my boss because Rick Snyder, when he was the governor, because he had a fixation with appropriations. You two probably know he never got off track. You know, you could ask him 10 questions and he's going to come back to the same answer all the time because he understood numbers, he understood budgets, and he understood the leverage that had. And he had a very good budget director, John Nixon first, and then John Roberts. You know, John Roberts probably the smartest. Well, he's not a kid anymore, but he was probably the smartest kid I ever worked with. And now, of course, you know, he's far beyond being a kid. He's, you know, pretty talented executive. But that's two, you know, pretty tremendous budget directors. And Rick always knew that stuff. So I think, you know, outfoxed isn't probably the right word. It's just the knowledge base. It's pretty even. Mm-hmm.
So you're not concerned that we don't have a budget yet. You think that they'll end up, this feeling out process will ultimately work itself out and eventually something will get passed at some point.
Yeah, I don't know about the last part. I'm not concerned about it because, well, I mean, you know, practically I'm a lobbyist, so, you know, chaos is always our best ally for business and in the political business. But I'm not particularly concerned about it because appropriations is something that comes together when people want it to. And if you need it, it comes together. If you don't need it, it doesn't. And right now, as far as I can tell, you know, the governor decided to do these line item veto stuff, which I would never have recommended that as a tactic, but didn't ask me anyway. So, and I'm sure they don't think I have any more knowledge today than I ever did. So when you're cutting a lot of money out of the budget with line item vetoes, you're walking right into kind of a trap that the Republicans have because for 40 years I've been in town, they've been trying to cut $1 billion out of the budget. And she kind of did it for them. I think she felt that these things that she cut out of the budget, they really needed. And I think she's discovered that she needed them too. They weren't just a one-way deal. Well, when you're a legislative leader, you know, you really don't run the state. The governor runs the state. And so, you know, the responsibility for straightening stuff out really starts with the governor. So now they're in a situation where they're kind of sitting back saying, your move, and what do you want to do next?
Sort of thinking back to the last time we had divided government, the Granholm administration, and sort of over your tenure, is it more partisan now? Is where we're at part of sort of the, what they call a hyper-partisan move, or is it just we're getting used to divided government again?
Yeah, I think it's probably more partisan. I'm a little struck by the fact that when Granholm was the governor and we had this divided government, which I assume is the part you're talking about, you know, I don't really think that she knew as much about the process as Gretchen Whitmer does. And therefore, I think people have higher expectations of what Governor Whitmer is going to do in response to, you know, political gamesmanship than they did think what Granholm was going to do because she didn't have the experience. So the expectations were higher. And now she's discovered that when Granholm was in, especially in the second term, when the economy went to hell, everybody said, oh, well, she's, you know, she can't do anything. The first term they kind of forgot because when she came into office, she had a pretty good staffing. And it did make some difference because she had Rick there, Rick Weiner. So I think, you know, it's different. It's just different, different times. You know, Trump encourages this hyper-partisanship down the line, but it really started with Newt Gingrich when he took over the House, and it's just kind of permeated over the last 25 years. I don't think it's anything particularly new. I mean, you know, the country's done this for 20 years, 30 years, it's all the same. I mean,
well, let's back up to when the governor first introduced the 45 cent a gallon gas tax increase. Now, let's say that you're her chief of staff here and she needs the legislature to pass some type of additional road funding. She saw those vetoes as giving her leverage to be able to get that from the legislature at some point. You said you wouldn't have recommended doing the line item vetoes. So if not that, then how do you get them to ultimately approve some additional revenue for the roads?
Well, I thought she had the right technique when she started because everybody, she ran on that. So she threw out this big number, but she told everybody she was going to throw out the big number, and that's how much they needed. So now the question was, what was she going to end up with? And she, you know, she got stuck on her 45 cent thing, and I think the Republicans probably would have made a deal with her for something less than that early on. Rick Snyder was always convinced that you had to do the budget early. You had to get it done. And the reason that I thought that that was a great technique was because everything flows from it. You know, once you get the budget done, you know, you do all this other legislation stuff. But when the budget's hanging out there, you don't do anything else because everybody's all obsessed by the budget. So Rick always wanted to get it done by May so they'd get it off the boards. And therefore, you could turn your attention for the next, essentially the next 9 to 10 months towards a bunch of other issues that were important to people. And that's kind of the way he operated. And every year for 8 years, he got it done by June, and it was done. And that's because he drove it to be done. When he got screwed up was when he made a ballot issue too complicated. You know, Jace Bolger refused to pass a simple ballot issue on roads. And they got on this convoluted deal where they were going to do all these kinds of pieces to this thing, which the public can't stand. People that aren't in politics all the time, all their lives, I don't think they grasp it as much as they think they do because they're on the outside of politics and they don't see it. But I haven't seen any difference between this and the 1970s. They're not going to vote for 45 cents for gas tax. I don't care what you do. I don't care what you say. It's going to happen. And it hasn't happened in 50 years. It's not going to happen now. And so you need to find somewhere in between. And then when in the Snyder administration, then they tried to find something in between, and then they got too clever. and the ballot issue was this convoluted mess that no one was going to vote for because nobody understood it except Rick, because he was brilliant and he could understand these complicated tanglements, but nobody understands that stuff. And so, you know, if the lobbyists in town can't understand what you're doing, nobody can, because they explain confusing stuff that their clients come up with every day.
Yeah, that's your job almost. So basically, Whitmer had to cut a deal early on the number, not be so fixed on 45 cents, get something in between and make it a part of a bigger package that the Republican legislature could have got a win or two out of.
Yeah, I think so. I think all people that run for office get tied up in their own rhetoric. They feel like if they don't follow through with what they said they were doing in the campaign, that they're going to be accused of lying to the public or, you know, misleading the public. And so she didn't want to go back on this major infrastructure program that she had. And that was, you know, that's her personal feeling about, you know, the public. She made a commitment and she was going to follow through with it. I don't see anything wrong with that. I just don't think it works.
Going back to, sorry to put you into the role of her chief of staff. But
I don't think she'd like that very much, to be frank.
I suspect she probably wouldn't. But let's say this was Rick Snyder in this situation. And he said to you, he said, Dennis, he says, how do I get out of this box? What would you tell him?
I think I would say right now, I don't know. I'll go over and make a deal with the Speaker and the Majority Leader on 10 bills that they want us to sign that we really don't like. And I'll tell them what we want that they really don't like. And then we'll sit there with a pen and we'll draw lines through ones and see if we can end up with 6 or 7 or 8 that we can stomach. And then we'll try to go forward with those. That necessitates that you have the money to pay for them. So therefore, now you've got 6 or 7 that you can agree on. Mm-hmm. And so you go back and you say, okay, well, where do we get this out of the budget? Well, we got to do this, we got to do this, we got to do this. And then that folds those back into the budget. Okay, now our agreement's not just on 6 or 7 points of view and issues. It's on 6 or 7 points of view and the 6 or 7 parts of the appropriations process that you got to have to fund them. That's what I'd do. I mean, if he asked me, that's what I'd tell him I would do.
Would you advise him to sign a statute that took away that admin board transfer authority?
No, never. Never give up executive power.
Shirky says he won't cut a deal unless it's in statute.
Oh, yeah, sure he will. You know, he's a smart guy. Depends on what the deal is.
Yeah.
You know, so... legislators, I mean, the governor's, her personality, she can get stubborn. And that's been kind of her modus operandi. And Mike Shirking can get stubborn. And that's kind of been his modus operandi. So I think maybe Lee Chatfield...
Trying to grease the wheels a little bit.
Could work both of them. That doesn't mean Chatfield's are more pliable. It just means that's the way Lee, I think, wants to look at stuff. And I think, you know, the three of them can find some agreement. They're fairly similar personality-wise. Chatfield a little less than the other two.
You want to go take Dennis in the Wayback Machine?
Are there any stories that you're comfortable sharing with us from your experience as Chief of Staff to Rick Snyder that maybe the public didn't hear about or that our listenership, our readership might find fascinating?
You know, it's sometimes tough to talk about, but I think when the governor did right to work, he had a higher purpose in doing it. He wanted to take Michigan from being a state that corporations crossed off of their location list because we were reputed to be controlled by unions. So if you came in here with a business, you had to deal with the unions and, you know, they would cross you off the list. And I think he felt that the right to work wouldn't accomplish what some of the conservative constituency thought it would, but it would accomplish a national image change. And I think it did that, clearly. It clearly did that. Irritated the hell out of the unions. And you know, kind of, I don't think it's proven to be as nearly as difficult for them as they suspected. It has for some of the unions, but not for all of them. The economy is riding pretty high, so union membership is pretty high in the areas where you would typically think it might have been impacted. I mean, I think the union that was most mad about the whole thing, well, I don't know. It's hard to judge which one was most mad, but carpenters got bent out of shape, but that was because they felt like they got misled by us. And there were other unions that knew that it was going to cause them trouble. The MEA, for one, knew it was going to cause them membership trouble. A lot of these unions have tremendous programs. The building trades have tremendous apprenticeship programs, tremendous programs for pensions and healthcare and et cetera themselves, and they run them themselves because of their membership, like the operating engineers. So they have business to manage internally themselves. So their concern was always that, their membership would go down and there wouldn't be as many people contributing to their pension fund. Now, that's what's happened to the carpenters, but it hasn't happened to some of the rest of them. So I think it had a little less impact than they really thought it was going to.
So some of the urban myth at the time, if I remember right, was that the DeVos clan came down and Rick Snyder folded. It was more of a messaging thing that he wanted to sort of change the national perception.
Yeah, it was a national perception thing, I think, and people misunderstood that.
Well, we all were under the impression that it wasn't on his agenda, that he wasn't in support of right to work.
Yeah, well, I don't think he was in support of right to work as what right to work is. And I think that's what he was saying. I mean, I'm not in support of decimating union ranks to pass right to work. That was never his agenda. What his agenda was to build, retraining programming and to build this relationship where they could convince a company to locate because the unions were in the deal. And it didn't work out as they went along. And then it became a question of, what are we going to do with right to work? And it became this, it's an image conscious thing. The longer you thought about it, the more they realized it. And, for some of us, it was a very difficult thing to do because, I work for the governor. It doesn't matter what I think. Who cares what I think? That's not important.
All right. Well, I think we've exhausted our time.
Okay.
For today, we appreciate you coming by. We got to have you more often. You do it.
Will
you?
Turn the heat on.
Yeah, we'll turn the heat on.
I'll put an extra piece of coal in the thing.
I can't guarantee I'll have you on as much as Michael Patrick has you on.
Oh, he only has me on once a week.
Yeah, I know. We only do this once a week, though.
Oh, there you go. Well, you can't do it with me every week, so I run out of stories after a while.
I don't know. I find that hard to believe. I've got to imagine you've got a lot of stories.
Well, if I go way back into the 70s, I can really come up with some stories.
All right. See, that's what I thought. That's what I thought.
Christmas time. We can talk about the Christmas parties in the Capitol building.
We'll save that for the Christmas edition, eh, John?
I would say there's some lawmakers that we worried, but they're all turned out and gone.
No, they're long gone. Most of them are dead by now. There's a couple of them that are still around.
Dennis Muchmore from Honigman, thanks so much for coming.
My pleasure.
Joining us on the other end of the line is State Representative Joe Tate out of Detroit. Thanks for joining us on the podcast today.
Oh, thanks a lot, Kyle and Mike. I appreciate it.
Now, I wanted to have you on the podcast this week because today is Veterans Day, and folks know that you played football, but there's a lot of folks don't know that you actually got into the military after your time playing football, and I wanted to see if you could share for our listeners why you decided to do that and the story behind you getting into the military.
Yeah, sure. So it really for me it was all about service. So growing up, my dad was a firefighter for the city of Detroit, and my mom was a public school teacher there. And when I was a baby, I was only a few months old. My father passed away in the line of duty. And I always knew that growing up, you know, just hearing stories about what my father did, it stuck with me. And I think my mom and friends and family kind of embedded this idea of service. You know, you give back to your community. You give back to the place that raised you. And you know, I went off and played football. And after my football career was over with, I started to figure out, okay, how can I give back to my community? What does that look like? So this was 2008. The war was still going on in Iraq and Afghanistan. And I decided to join in the military. In fact, I think I was looking at several service organizations, and one was the Peace Corps. So it was actually between the Peace Corps and the Marine Corps. I felt that, you know, my skill sets would be better utilized as a Marine.
So when you decided to join the Marines, didn't you have some type of recommendations to go along with that to help you get into the Marines?
Yeah, I had to have a waiver when I was coming out, because I was commissioned so late. I believe it was 28 was the cutoff at that time, and I had to have a waiver.
So how old were you?
I was 28.
Wow, so you were joining the Marines at age 28, so you were an old man, basically.
I was an old man. I was, and, you know, at the time I was, I got done with my football career. I thought I was going into coaching, so I was in East Lansing at the time. I was a graduate assistant working in football. It was Coach D'Antonio's first year. I decided to join up. And so I had to get a waiver, an age waiver, in order to join the service.
So where were you? Did you deploy somewhere?
I did. I was did my initial training in Quantico, Virginia. All Marine officers go there for training initially, and I went off to Hawaii, which is, as you know, a terrible place to go.
there are worse assignments.
There are. And I was with 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marine, so I was an infantry officer. I did 2 deployments over to Afghanistan, so we were rotating from our units. We're rotating from Hawaii to Helmand Province, Afghanistan at the time. I did 2 deployments in 2010 and 2011.
So what was it like being the 28-year-old with Marines who probably, in a lot of cases, were just coming out of high school? Was there a noticeable age difference?
I don't think so. On the officer side, I don't think most people knew how old I was. And usually with officers, they're coming right out of college for the most part. So, you know, you're probably 22 to 24 years old. On the officer side, and on the enlisted side, they're coming usually right out of high school. And but there wasn't a noticeable difference for me, because as an officer, we all receive the same training. We all go through the same training and to prepare for our roles as officers.
So what was your impression of what was going on in Afghanistan at the time?
One of the things, you know, we were sent there to do, we're providing security in order to kind of support the government in Afghanistan, JIRAWA, the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan. And in order to kind of help them and support and ensure that there was a legitimate, or what the people saw as a legitimate government there. And, you know, obviously the Taliban was there, and so we were trying and in place to provide security for the local Afghans, and did what's called counterinsurgency operations as well, too. So really engaging with the locals there as well as providing security, so helping out, too, with different types of projects, helping to support locals to build wells and kind of build out their infrastructure for them to make a living and kind of provide for their families.
So what was the reaction in Afghanistan to Americans when you were there? How did they receive you and your fellow Marines at the time?
I think that there was a certain amount of skepticism there, and it took some time to really build some relationships, at least during my time there. Obviously, that's kind of a small snapshot of what took place over time there. But there was, I think, initially some skepticism, and I think that was there for a long time, and certainly still is. But I think we attempted to make some headway and to supporting the government there. There are some people I think we could never convince that we were there to support them. But there were others I think we were able to help, including like the local police and the local army, to teach them different tactics in order for them to thrive.
Was it hot out there all the time?
Yes. It was like being in the desert. It was a desert climate. And summers were extremely hot. We got to 110, 115 at times during the day there. And then during the winter time, the winter months, it would cool down significantly. You can compare it to Southern California, kind of in the desert.
Arizona?
So Mojave Desert. Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Mojave, Arizona.
And then as a veteran, how do you feel like you're treated and your other former military are treated?
I think, I'm very appreciative of community here in Michigan and across the nation appreciating veterans. And especially now, these days, the people that go off and serve, it's in the single digits now. So I'm really appreciative of that. One of the things that I think as we start kind of moving along, and one of the things that I'm certainly interested in is how can we leverage the skill sets veterans bring back with them through their experiences to help their communities. We have that. There are a lot of organizations that do that and bring veterans in for a second service, so to speak. But, how can we do a better job? Not to say that thank you for your service is important. I think people need to hear that. But going beyond it, like thank you for your service, but maybe here's what else you can do as well. Because, we need those experiences. We need those in our communities, especially in Michigan, but, across the nation too.
Well, so how would you describe the skill set that you're referring to? What special skills would a veteran have that somebody who didn't serve in the military wouldn't?
So there are several. So it's more, I was an infantry officer. So I don't think kind of the technical skills that I learned are probably not applicable to what I do now as an elected official. But the skills that you learn around leadership, I think that's the biggest thing. Leadership, accountability, being able to assess situations and coming up with a solution immediately, even if it's not the most complete, but being able to execute on that. One of the big things that we're taught is taking initiative and being aggressive in what we do. I think those carry over. I think especially in other organizations that where it can be useful. So I think it's more so kind of the leadership skills that we were taught in the military, which I think is one of the, the U.S. military, I think it's just a leader in developing leaders. So I think that's kind of the big skill that can be leveraged from veterans.
I'm taking a look here at the supporting MI veterans bills that House Democrats put out on Friday, and I'm counting some, 25, 26 different pieces of legislation you guys are putting on the table? This is pretty extensive.
Yes, it's a significant amount of bills that we do have, and obviously I'm biased, so anything that we can do to help support veterans, I'm certainly all for. One point I want to note is a House resolution that hasn't been introduced, but Senator Gary Peters has, at the federal level, has been doing a lot of work around veterans issues, and one is around expanding opportunities for apprenticeships for veterans. The Senate bill number escapes me right now, but it's bipartisan legislation, which would allow veterans to use their G GI Bill benefits and more registered apprenticeships. So in the state of Michigan, you have over 1,000 registered apprenticeships, but only 231 in the state of Michigan. Veterans are able to use their benefits to support those apprenticeships. So I think that's one that I think that I'm keeping a close eye on, as well as the other bills that we have introduced in the state too.
One of the bills that you have here is requires a price preference for veteran-owned businesses when soliciting goods or services from the state of Michigan. I think we've tried that before and never really seems to get off of first base. Do you feel like there's more incentive that the public at large is embracing their veterans and more than maybe in years past, and maybe that this is a bill whose time will come eventually?
I think so. I've had a couple of conversations with Representative Shepherd in regards to this, and that's where the House bill is at, the price preference bill for veteran-owned businesses. I think that there is an opportunity there to look at that. Currently, the state of Michigan provides a 10% price preference for disabled veteran-owned businesses. So what we're looking at doing is just trying to expand that out to veteran-owned businesses as a whole, and ensuring that they do have, you know, opportunities, or they do have the ability to get plugged in into our state's supply chain. I think that's important. I think it's, you know, certainly something that's not partisan by any means. You know, obviously speaking to Representative Shepherd about it, so I'm excited about that bill. I think it will have some traction in this session.
And then the last thing we wanted to ask you about before we let you go, obviously this past week you got a lot of publicity about your NCAA athletes bill. And I wanted to see what kind of reaction you've received from that, and if you feel optimistic that that bill could be moving.
I think so. I think we've, both Representative Iden and I, have received quite a bit of positive feedback on the bills. We just introduced those last week. And I think we will be having conversations here in the near future. I know I've had a couple of preliminary conversations on my end from various stakeholders. But I think that there is an appetite for that, and to have some conversations around it as well, to make sure that you know, it is the right legislation that we need to have in the state of Michigan to support student athletes.
So you're still a relatively young guy, but one of the things that old veterans like to do is tell old war stories. Do you have any good war stories that you'd be willing to share that kind of encapsulates your experience in Afghanistan?
Nothing specific. Big takeaways that I had, you know, being over serving my country, is just the Marines and sailors that, you know, I either commanded or served with. I mean, yeah, I was an older guy coming in, but, you know, you hear a lot of those stories too, about, you know, these young guys that are just out of high school and, you know, come out and come from different backgrounds and are able to come together and fight for the same cause. And usually it's, you know, you're fighting for the guy that's right next to you. That's really the big, I wish there was one specific story. There are numerous specific stories, but the big thing that, as I get further and further away from my military career, is just the heroes that I've seen overseas and just the amazing things that they've done. It's certainly timely. I'm glad we do have Veterans Day to honor those men and women that served. But I'm really grateful and thankful for the people that I served with.
Well, I'm thankful you were able to have some time with us today. Thank you for your service, Representative Tate.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Kyle. I really appreciate it.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Thanks to Dennis Muchmore for coming into MERS World Headquarters. Representative Joe Tate for his time, also for the podcast, John Roering, Mike Malott, and also special thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Until next week, I'm Kyle Mullin. Take care.